Blog Talk Radio.
Great, man. Been busy, really busy, but I'm told by the older folks that that's supposed to be a good thing, so I'm going to bank on that.
Yeah, really.
It is, huh? That it is. You stay busy, you stay out of trouble, I guess, for the most part.
That's
the thing about it. Yes. As I was saying earlier, June is kind of rolling out the way July is coming in. We're going to do something different for July, but we're going to, for July and August, we're going to do two shows each month. Our next show, we're going to skip 4th of July weekend. We'll go black on that weekend and enjoy ourselves for 4th of July weekend. We'll come back July 11th, and we'll do July 25th for the month of July. And when July 11th comes, that show, we're going to open up a segment, start a segment, and call Up From the Ashes. I'm going to speak with a young lady that's going to come on and share a story. And it's based around child molestation, how she dealt with it, how she grew up with it, and where she is now. That's going to be powerful, so we look forward to that. But tonight, we'll do something a little different. I came across a little writing that I found to be very interesting, and it kind of took me a place. I said, you know what, we've got to put this on the show and kind of take a look at it. But it made me really think about, in the sense that men, for the most part, you know, we quietly, we're dating or doing something of that nature, we're quietly and diligently going out and checking for a partner. Where sometimes women's kind of basically looking for a husband. I know people say, what's the difference between a husband and a partner? You give me a few minutes, I'll explain that to you. But it's interesting for a man, the woman that he decides to choose as a partner can affect every aspect of his life, his mental health, his peace of mind, his love inside of himself, his happiness, and how he will basically deal and get through tragedies. And sometimes it kind of basically deals with success. Of course, it may deal with the fact of how his children will be raised and much, much more. And I hear people say, you know, well, what's the difference with a woman choosing a husband? Well, in a sense, I will say the major difference in a sense is that men, in a sense, when we're dating, I believe, Mr. Reeves, we're looking for those things and we're not putting them out there in the forefront, but those are some of the check marks that we might be looking for. So when we think about a partner that we want to spend time with, maybe long-term time with, are these elements that were stated, do they appeal to what we're thinking, even when we're doing small things on a date or hanging out with someone?
Yeah, I think when we, if I understood the question, I think when we're looking for a wife, we're looking for more of a life partner that we can get along with, we can live at peace with. Of course, the physical and the mental and the spiritual, we're all connected. We're all blending into that. We know each other. We want to enhance our relationship and make each other better. And I think we do look for that when we are looking for a potential mate. We're looking for that in that particular mate. And chances are, if we don't see that in that particular mate, then we most times kind of steer away from that mate. Other guys sometimes make the mistake of going on thinking that they're going to get that in that particular mate, get married, and never find it. So I know you and I are divorced. I know from conversations we've had in the past, we are very clear on what we want with a potential wife moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And because we saw the example of what we did not want in our first marriages.
Let's go there, man.
Let's go back to our first marriages. Let's go back to where we were still single bachelors and at the doorsteps of getting married for the most part. And I'm going back to the list just a little bit. And if you can remember back then, I know it's been a while, my brother, but if you can remember back then, I'll go to the list again. If you can remember back then, I want you to kind of tell me back then what was kind of really on the forefront of your mind. Because as we age, what we see and what we want are different. But I'm going to go back with when you met your ex-wife and you deemed her to be someone that you want to spend the rest of your life with, did you look at her as someone that can basically affect your mental health? Did you look at her as someone that was going to offer you peace of mind? Did you look at her as someone that's going to help bring you happiness? Did you feel at the time of saying I do to her that she's going to help you get through tragedies?
Man, unfortunately not. And I think I mentioned on the show, that's what I wanted as far as peace of mind, mental health, all that stuff. But the major push for my decision to get married is that we had shared a child together, and then there was another child on the way, and I wanted to be there as a father in the household to solidify the family. It wasn't necessarily if I thought she could bring that, all the things on your list. It was more so of, okay, I have two children by this woman. Let me make an honest woman of her, and let me be step up and be the family man that I should be. And I kind of got that from, you know, from our parents, you know, being old school, and you know, you got to be there as a dad, and you got to be, you know, you got to take care of your family. And at the time, I didn't think there was any other. It wasn't about me at the time. It was about how do I step in and be a family man. And step in and raise children, make an honest woman out of my ex-wife, so that she wouldn't feel that she was, you know, left holding the bag. And so I wanted those things, but in my heart of hearts, standing there in front of the Justice of Peace, I knew that I was sacrificing those things to try to be more of a father and a family person, as opposed to getting what I wanted, to be honest. If that makes sense.
No, bro, that makes a lot of sense.
And you hit something that kind of really rung home here. And sacrifice. Because the things I mentioned, I can't say I knew they were there when I was getting married either. I didn't really believe or knew for sure that she would be a benefit to my mental health. Wasn't sure that she would bring peace of mind. You know, hope that would be the case. Happiness, I kind of could say, okay. And it's interesting, I didn't think about this maybe prior, before, about the tragedies, to actually say I do, but I knew shortly after that I may not be able to trust her on tragedies. Just wasn't sure. And it was nothing that she said or kind of did, but it was just an inside gut feeling that just permeated throughout the time I was married. And it's interesting because when you say sacrifice, I think, you know, you and I and a lot of men could probably attribute this, that when we take that step sometimes, we sacrifice some things hoping that they will get better at that particular time, and we'll work through it, and things are kind of come around. And then when they may not come around, there lies some disappointment. Mr. Charles, we're basically speaking on some elements that, for the most part, quietly men seek when they're seeking a partner. And Mr. DeMarisa, I'll just speak on the fact that we both got married and what we were thinking about previously at point. But here's what the elements that most men kind of basically use as a marker, in a sense that they think about taking a woman on as a partner. You know, will she be someone that, you know, affects his mental health? Will she bring some peace of mind? Will she help kind of endure the love that's inside of him? Will she bring him happiness? Will she help him through the tough times when tragedies come around? Will she basically add a plus to his success? And how will she help him in the sense of raising children? When you hear that, all dated, you know, once again, Mr. DeRius and I were married. We know that you never took that step, and I always say, man, you're my hero for not doing so. And I say that in a sense, too, because if you didn't find all these things, you were, you know, you were strong enough. If you didn't have all these things, you chose not to walk over that room, walk over that line, and that I always admire. But the question I want to give to you, when you're looking for these elements, are these some of the things that you look for, maybe the reason why you chose not to step over the room or jump the room that they sort of say, from time to time?
I'll say this. First of all, there's one definite reason why I would have done it. And I wouldn't say that because I didn't find them, that's why I didn't do it. I think I was too, I always wanted to be the perfectionist. And I knew that was never going to happen. And I think that delayed my ever getting married because I saw other people's relationship. And, you know, I just wanted to be perfect, and it couldn't be that way. And I kept waiting and waiting and waiting, and that just kind of held me back. Not saying I wouldn't have done it if I felt like it, but when I thought it was right, there was always something that made me go, that's not right. But if I did choose one that would say, if a person, my mate, I hope that she had this or could do this for me in this sense, it would definitely be to make me happy, bro, to be happy. Because the other stuff, I've been so used to doing things on my own and having to carry the load. You know, I just want to be able to get along with somebody, somebody that wants to work with me, and somebody that definitely wants to work towards having a joyful, fun life, man, and enjoying life because it is so short. That would be my thing. Because the rest of it, being alone for this long, and even when I was younger, I could do the rest of it by myself. I mean, it would be nice to have somebody, but when you get used to doing things independently, you just want to be happy, have somebody you can enjoy life with and sit on the porch, man, drink Kool-Aid, lemonade, and eat popsicles with, bro, in your old age. Keep it 100, bro.
I got your 100, bro. I hear you. Trust me, I hear you. But I'm going to go through a thing. I'm going to go through someone that kind of been in the battle, such as myself. When you really say that, Mr. Rich, what's your first reaction, my brother?
I think I said this last week. I know we're going to do something a little later, but, man, I got to have it all with the mate. Because if they're expecting all from me, I got to have it all from them. And, you know, it's nothing worse than sitting in a house with somebody and you know you're not getting all that you need from them. And it's very easy to venture out somewhere else and get it. It's very easy to do that. So if it's lacking at home, you're going to feel it some kind of way. And it may not be good. That's what I was thinking when you were saying all that, because you know, what somebody's not doing at home, somebody out there could do, and they find out that it's not being done at home, oh, man, the temptation is so great that you're like, you know what, I'm going to steal a little piece of this while I'm out here because I deserve it because I ain't getting it, and I'm supposed to get it. And you'll justify it. You'll justify all that stuff because of what you're lacking at home. So if the person at home is not giving it, you know, maybe it's not the right person. But, if my mate is expecting all from me as far as the happiness, mental, and all that other stuff, they got to give it back to me too, or it's going to be unbalanced. And you know, as men, sometimes we tend to wander, and we tend to find it in places we didn't expect to find it, and we will indulge.
Can I throw something in there real quick?
Oh, sure.
Can I throw something in there?
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say this. Y'all have been married. I have not. Let me just say this, and I think this is where it's different for me. The way I grew up and the way I understand I had to live my life, I would love for my mate and my person to be that everything for me. But realistically, I know it's not going to happen. I'm not saying she shouldn't try and she shouldn't go the extra mile, whatever it may be. But, dude, for me, nah, man. That's the case. I might as well commit suicide, bro. See, now, ain't no way in hell. I'm just keeping it real. He ain't going to be able to do it for me. You know, what I had to go through and what I had to experience and what I had to conquer through the grace of God, shit, you can't do that. So I was honest. Okay, we should try, be good, let's be in a position where we are trying to live life together and make it work out. But, you know, certain things certain people are not capable of doing. So I had to come to grips with that. And maybe we just all different, and I ain't mad at nobody, but shit, you can't do that for me, bro. Maybe that's my problem. I'm not vulnerable enough, right? I've been told that before, too. I'm not open enough. I'm not vulnerable to be hurt. Okay, well, I guess I'll be by myself. Anyway, sorry about that. I just had to share that.
No,
no problem.
Here. No, bro.
No, and it's not. I don't want you to think that we're picking on your answer, but I think something happens, bro. And I hear you with the happiness, and that's beautiful. Don't get me wrong. But there's something that happens when you come home to somebody day in and day out. Day in and day out. It's a different thing when they're in your space for a period of time and they move on. But when you're coming home to someone day in and day out, and the effort is not there for some of these elements that we're speaking of, it starts to bother you. It just does. Now, some people aren't capable of giving all that, and I agree with you, Mr. Charles. Some people just don't have it, it's not possible. But effort has to be made. And when there's no effort, that's where the imbalance comes in. Because as Mr. Marie stated, that if you're given that and it's not being reciprocated, it's not coming back, there's a problem. Whether you want to own up to it, acknowledge it, deal with it, face it or not, it presents a problem. It just does. And that's where that balance comes in. And I think for some people, I think, and this could be on the other side of the fence with the woman, too. I think some people, once they got married, okay, the hard part is over. You know, now we just coast along. We just roll along. I don't have any work to do. There's nothing to do. And that's where I think that balance starts to happen as well. They don't realize that if you're taking on a partner, if you're taking on this person, if you're stepping into this person's space, and you're there day in and day out, there are certain things that you must kind of meet for that person, both sides, not one-sided, both sides in a sense. So what you're probably hearing me, Mr. Pierce and I saying that since we've both been married, we realized once we were in it, some things we didn't think about going into it. You know, some of the things that we didn't kind of just figure, you know what, it may not be here today, but it might pop up tomorrow. But when it didn't pop up, we was like, oh, shoot. You know, I really want that, but I don't have it. You know, oh, shoot, I want that, but I don't have it. And then you find yourself with, okay, this person I'm coming home to every single day, they're not given this, but they're expecting this. They're expecting that. But they're picking and choosing what they want to give and how they want to give it. And that's where the imbalance starts. And that's where sometimes, as was stated, where someone else sometimes fills in that gap of what that person may not be giving. Not that it's right, but it tends to happen more times than not. I'm going to come back to you with this question, Mr. Charles. You know, when you say happiness, I guess you kind of basically answer this, you know, previously, but there's another thing that you can take away, elements you can take away that, you know, wasn't important to you from the elements that were listed. Let's say we'll go with that one first. Yeah, we can just take one with it. Really didn't matter to you, which one would it be?
Well, you said, what was the other? You said, what was the mental, there was the mental, what was something about that? What was the other?
It was mental
health, peace of mind, the love inside of you. You know, happiness, helping you through tragedies, really kind of being an asset for your success, and helping you in the end of raising children.
If I had to take one away, probably since I can't take my happiness away, that ain't going nowhere. We just had to disagree on that one. Not disagree, but we'll have to have an understanding about that one. But probably the mental, man. The mental. And the reason why I say that is because, if I'm understanding this correctly, I'm not saying that the person should be there for you mentally or try to help you with that, the mindset that you might be going through some things. But I don't know. I think if I was married, that would be a hard one for me to turn over to somebody because of the tragedies and the hell I've been through, man, and then just the connection with the Lord. I mean, it's just hard, man, because you know I guess maybe this is just me, and maybe I'm a pessimist in this way, that the average person can't handle that, bro. They can't handle that mental. They don't understand it because most of them have been through it. And when you've been through the madness, bro, truthfully, I really wouldn't expect them to handle that part of it. You can try to support me. I hear what you guys are saying. I think the effort is noble. But realistically, I may never say it, but I don't even know if you're capable. I don't know if my mate would be capable to handle that middle side. And this man, dude, I mean, I could get D. Maurice knows, man. I went through hell in the hair basket. And then you call me, what's wrong with you? What? You can't even pay the damn light bill and the car on them time. And if we get close to somebody not going to their favorite restaurant, then that's a damn problem. Really? Come on, man. Nah, bro. Oh, my goodness. That's crazy.
This is what I hear a little bit from you, bro. Somebody just asked in a sense that when you say they can't handle it, is it possible that you don't trust them to handle it, or you just know from your heart they can't handle it?
I think it's not so much to trust because, you know, unfortunately, I have to admit this, I study people, man, and I only go off of what, I can only go off what you show me, right? You know, people are like, well, you didn't give her a chance. And I'm like, but your actions show me that you're not possibly capable of doing that. So my question is, should I trust, should I let them have the opportunity? But you have to show me. Because if you can't handle it and we risk it and I turn it over to you and then it goes south, whose fault is that? Is that mine because I let you handle it, try to, you messed it up? Or is it yours because you said you could handle it? I don't know. That's just I just think it's probably because they haven't shown me, if that answers your question, they haven't shown me that they're capable of handling it. I guess that would be my answer. Mm-hmm.
No, I hear you.
Mr. DeMaurice, if you have to basically take one element away, sir, which one would be and why?
I think, I mean, you're responsible for your own happiness. You're supposed to contribute to that. But I think I would probably have to go with happiness, because that's how you perceive things and how it's a choice that you make. Personal choice you make that you're going to be happy regardless. I was thinking about the mental and the part about somebody being there in tragic times. And I remember when I was married, my mom died quickly after, like 2 weeks after I got married. And this stuck out. I remember this before, but it kind of came back during this conversation. I was kind of going through some things, you know. So I was, you know, it's real weird to bury a parent or put, you know, all the stuff together to bury a parent. And I remember during that time we were in North Carolina, all my ex-wife could think about is going to this restaurant that we went to the first time she was there. It was like she had no concern about, you know, the tragedy that happened, things of that sort. And I knew right then and there, 6 years prior to the divorce, that this was not going to work. When I needed support, I knew, I knew that any time I was going through some things, that she was not going to be there. And so it proved itself over and over and over again. So I'm kind of torn between the mental and the happiness, but I'll go with the happiness because, as I said, I went to talk to people who did understand what I was going through and left her out outside because I knew I wasn't going to get that support. But I gravitated towards people who would give me that support during those traumatic times because I knew that wasn't in her. And that became a deal breaker for me. That first time it happened, and I remember it vividly, I was sitting in the restaurant, and I don't even know if I really touched my food. But I was just sitting there, and I swear, it's like it happened yesterday. this is not going to work. In my hour of need, when I need somebody to support me, when I'm not feeling okay, this woman is not capable of doing it. And I decided right there, it was almost like the chain started moving right there, process of divorce, right then and there. And over time, over and over again, things would happen, and that was my heavy load, and it wasn't being carried and all that other stuff. I'm like, okay, I got to learn how to do this. So I've done that before with the mental and handling the tragedy. But what I did was is that during that time, I made a decision to be happy. I made a decision to be happy and do the things that made me happy. And so I can give up happiness with the array of options that you're presenting right now.
Wow, bro.
I think I've experienced this, so for me it would have to be going through tragedies. That one I can definitely give up because I like what Mr. Charles was saying. I don't think some people are cut out for it. I don't think they really know what to say, what to do. And in a sense, it's kind of left upon you anyway. And then for the most part, I want to kind of deal with it on my own for the most part anyway. But I've kind of experienced something similar to you, Mr. DeVries, when my mother passed. And it was interesting that I heard at the time. At the time, I wasn't married, but I heard, we all gotta die someday.
Wow.
Yeah, that's flattering right there, my brother. That's we all gotta do this someday. So it's like,
Wow.
But I'm gonna flip it. I'm gonna flip it in a way because if the shoe was on the other foot, if your ex-wife and the person that said that to me, if it was their mother, oh my goodness, bro. Could you imagine what would have been expected of you? What you should have been doing? What were you supposed to do? And to me, sometimes in tragedies, man, people do what they think they're programmed to do. Meaning that, I think realistically, your situation, what I just shared, they did what they're capable of, bro. That's who they are at heart. Because for the most part, people think sometimes that it happened, okay, I'm supposed to rush in and do X, Y, Z, and they don't know how. But what they don't know how to do, they expect to receive in that particular time itself, which I find to be really interesting. But, yeah, man, I think I would have to take tragedies away because I wouldn't want to expect someone to be able to handle that, add to it, help out, and then my expectations are not met. And as Mr. Charles said, sometimes you're used to dealing with certain things on your own. No one's really needed at that point to kind of really. It's nice if it is, if you can add something, but you can't really add, and you're gonna kind of basically show where, like I said, something that's just not even necessary. Say something to that extent, it kind of says more about the person that's saying it. And just like with your ex-wife, about the restaurant, which really shows there's no emotional attachment, no sensitivity, no sincerity at all. At all. I mean, at all. And that's rough. That's rough. I mean, but that is really rough. Now, with the same token, I'll come back to you, gentlemen. I'm going to ask you, I'll come to you first, Mr. DeVries, and ask basically, if you only could choose one, the rest of them have to be all taken off the list. You just need one to move on to be and to do what you got to do. What would that one element be, sir, and why?
That's a tough one, too. I think because of the decision I made early in the stage of the it was like 2 weeks into marriage, and I knew going in that it probably wasn't going to work, but that was kind of confirmation. I need somebody that's going to be supportive. I really do. I really do. Because I do a lot of things. And one of the things that I'm going to share that will help, hopefully, Mr. Charles, because he's about to finish a book, is that when I have accomplishments in my life, I want to be able to share it with people. And some of the, a lot of the confidence I had in my life, I haven't been able to share it. That support, somebody saying, you know, helping you all along the way. That to me means a lot, because you got somebody in your corner, no matter what's out there in the world and what people say, what people do. You got somebody in your corner that will understand and be empathetic to what you're going through, and to be able to support you when you're not strong as you want to be, or you're not as strong as you're capable of being, that person can step in and compliment what you're not getting at that particular time and recognize that. So I think I will have to have that along with it's a tug of war between raising children also, because you want to raise children that are productive citizens, and you want to give them all you can give them so they have a fighting chance. And so, again, not thinking of myself, but thinking about the kids and making sure that they have what they need from both parents to have a fighting chance in life, and to be well adjusted so they can move on and do what they need to do. So it's a tug of war between those two.
Okay. Mr. Charles,
one, you know, you can take everything off the table, but outside of happiness, my brother, outside of happiness,
you would do that, wouldn't you? Y'all, man, anyway, one day you'll understand what I'm telling you. One, dude, because you ain't worth a damn. Anyway, that's for another day. But I would probably say I'm kind of like D. Maurice. I'm torn on the support. But my problem with when you say support, it would have to be somebody that knows how to support. Like D. Maurice mentioned, if you just got somebody to say, oh, you're going to be all right, baby. I mean, that does nothing, bro.
Right.
Nothing. So they have to have the ability to support you properly. With that being said, I probably would choose the one about the kids and about the kids, because I'm with D. Maurice. The standpoint of with your children, I agree 100%. They have to have a fighting chance, and then that means collectively, as you're raising them as a unit, you guys got to be on the same page. And that might mean that your wife or your mate might choose to do some things a little differently, but you know the way that you have decided to raise your children, this is how we go about the business, right? We have to be on that side for them to have a fighting chance, because if something unfortunately happens to you or one of you or both of you, then what? This world's crazy, man. You know, I would not wish the way I grew up, experience I had to deal with on nobody or anyone. I mean, know how hard that is for children. The world is even more crazier now. So in order for those children to have that final chance, for them, I probably would go with the one about the children. But we have to be collective as a unit. The rest of it, I can probably handle on my own. I'll figure it out. But they have to know, because if some, God forbid, I know what I went through by myself for the most part, I'm not sure if my kids would be able to handle it the way I did.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to
take a different path here, too, gentlemen. I'm going to take peace of mind, bro. Because to me, that's, at the end of the day, that has to be maintained at all costs. It just has to be. And to me, if you're taken away from that, there's a problem.
You know,
that's something I fight hard to maintain. Fight hard to develop over the years and grab a hold to. So to me, anything, that has to be one thing. It's interesting because I hear you say, Mr. Gibson, you know, Mr. Charles, we're kind of finishing this book. Happy here, Mr. Charles, we're rooting for you, my brother. And I realize, and all three of us were doing different things at different times, and I love that. I love that we're finding things to do. And something happened to me within the past week. And it's been a labor of love, but it was something that happened. And when it happened, it kind of signified just where I've been and kind of how I traveled. And it said that a few years ago, I decided to pick up a camera and kind of make a business out of it. Taught myself what I needed to know, really, you know, refined and studied what I had to do. Went out there and banged my head on some walls, different things. And I'm going to tell you now, you put a camera in my hand, I'm a bad man. I ain't going to lie. Bad man. And I got my first booking, paid booking, a little less than a week ago. And for me, that was like, whoa. It was just like, yeah, okay. Now, I don't expect anyone, because they really haven't traveled that road with me, to fully understand that. And so when things accomplish, come like Mr. Charles said, they can say it, or, you know, and that sounds good. But if you haven't, it's hard for that person, because if they haven't pushed the sleeves up like you did, it really got dirty. It just can't. And sometimes during the process, while you're getting dirty and getting it done, they don't understand that you're doing it. They don't understand why you're spending the time doing it. They don't understand why you're giving it that. Because they can't, they don't see the vision that you have. And they don't understand that the little maybe minute stuff that you're doing, it fits into the puzzle to get you where you need to be. But for me, man, just, I know sometimes in the past I've done some things and told some folks I was doing some things. And they really had no interest in hearing it. But upon a completion, they rally. They want to be there to rally and basically come with the dead balloons. And I'm like, I don't need it at that point. I really don't, because, you know, the work basically itself speaks for itself. It just does. It just speaks for itself within me. So to me, if when I'm grinding and you're supportive of the grinding, that's nice. But I prefer that more so when the accomplishment comes. You know, you're ready to kind of pull out the balloons and the pom-poms, because the sincerity is along the process. When it's dirty, when it's ugly, when it's not pretty. And that, to me, would, you know, says a lot. So, yeah, man, I'm happy to hear that Mr. Charles is upon completion and then doing this thing. We can't wait to get down and read that, brother. Of course, you know, once you finish that, we got to talk about it here, my brother. We're going to talk about it here further. It's going to get done. But going back to the elements, I wanted to say, you know, those are elements and stuff that we're looking for, Mr. Charles. But does it seem like, you know, if you go back and look over your period of time when you've dealt with partners or, you know, someone that might have been really important in your life, does it seem like the elements of things that you might have been looking for or hoping to have, does it seem like it even mattered to them, or they just wanted you regardless anyway?
Wow. I think it mattered to a point, but I think that they were more or less into me for whatever I could present, because it was and let me not rephrase it, but let me make sure that I'm saying that correctly. Am I talking about the people, the aspects that I'm looking at for them, or are they looking for them inside of me?
In a sense where,
like the elements that we're looking for, like you're looking for, you know, mainly for you, happiness, what it was, but those elements that were listed, did it seem like they were happy to offer them up to you, or they just wanted you, and, you know, whether they were giving that to you or not, it shouldn't matter because they just want you.
Okay. I think that they wanted me, because as much as I wanted them to offer it, they were offering it up. Again, I'm not sure, unfortunately, if they were capable or they knew how to do it. And I think that's very important. I'm not sure if they knew about those elements. So, and I think that's something that as we move forward, particularly early in life, in relationships, We don't really often talk about those things or think about those things. We go out that thing that DeMaurice is chastising us for, that or chastising me for, that love thing. So we go off of that, and that does not hold the water. That does not buy the groceries. That does not comfort. It does not provide empathy. So I guess my answer would be for me, and not so much them offering it up, those elements up, because I'm not sure if they wanted to, or if they really knew how to.
That's an interesting response, man, because
I'm going to look at if they don't know how to. And that's what I find to be interesting in a sense, is that if you don't know how to, but you're expecting to get it, how does that work out? I don't understand that. It's like, okay, you're expecting to get it, but yet you don't know how. I may not want to offer that up. Same question for you, Mr. Maurice. It seems like in your past of your dealings, were they cognizant of the elements that you may have been seeking and that you may have wanted, or they just wanted you, or not looking to offer any of those elements, just looking to basically have you, and that's enough?
I think it's the latter, just looking to have me. I wasn't really concerned about the things that I was going through or the road I had to take to get to where I need to go to. It was just about being there at the end and acting like they were, all for it and on the ride along with me, and that wasn't the case. I'll give you a perfect example of that. I went to University of Chicago for grad school. And that's a tough school to get in and also to get out of. And all the while, I went to a part-time three-year program where the only thing I had time to do, especially in the fall and in the spring and winter, was to study, read, write papers, go to work full-time. I still work full-time. So taking care of everything as far as financial, and still going to school, grad school at night, coming home, my baby sometimes asleep or sometimes they're waiting up for me or I'll see them in the morning. Before I decided to take this road, my ex-wife, at the time she was my wife, she quit her job. So the whole load was on me as far as paying bills and all that other stuff. But when I finished the program, and it was almost like she was doing things throughout the 3 years to try to sabotage me getting to that point. But when I finished the program, she wanted to buy a dress to go to the graduation. And I'm like, why are you even going to the graduation? I want my children to be there. And my boy from Detroit came, and Mr. Charles Norm, Eddie came. And I'm like, Ed got the kids because I want my kids to see this accomplishment because they were walking with me throughout this whole process. I was sometimes taking them to school with me, taking them to the library with me, coming home because I had to relieve her mom from babysitting to make sure they were taken care of and going to bed. And so I was like, well, why do you want to be there at the end product when you never did anything to really kind of support it? It's almost like you try to sabotage. So that's what I'm saying. She wasn't on that whole ride with me because when I announced it that I got accepted, 2 weeks later, she took me out to dinner and said, well, I'm quitting my job. For what? That this is a big load. And so when I said, why are you even contemplating going? I said, because it's not like you're putting on the show for anybody. All my cohort in class know that you weren't being supported in 3 years because their spouses were supportive, but you were never seen there. So why would you even want to go? So it was about the show for her. It was about, I got this person that graduated from the University of Chicago. This is my spouse. It was about status for her. It wasn't about, and that was about me, but it wasn't about being there for the right thing. It was the end result. And so that gave you, me, the confirmation that in another 3 years, it's like once I get this degree, putting the divorce order in place, because if you're doing this during this tough time, I know there are going to be maybe tougher times coming ahead, and I can't carry this weight anymore. I cannot do that, and I need someone who's going to be there for the whole ride. You're not there with me through the whole ride, stay home. Don't act like you're happy for me at the end. And so it was about me. It wasn't any concern of what I was going through, the hard nights of studying, writing papers, doing all-nighters, making sure that my grades were up to par because if your grades sink, you get kicked out. So it wasn't any of that concern. She was making the weight heavier and heavier every year. And I'm like, okay, I see what's going on. I see what type of person this is. So I gotta move accordingly to make this work and then to get away from this person because the other caveat to that is that my last year of grad school, I went to go get a physical from my doctor, and he's like, man, you got too much stress in your life. I'm going to have to put you on blood pressure pills if you don't get some of the stress out of your life. I know you're going to school. I know you're working. If you got any other stress in your life, you need to get rid of it. And I'm like, God, it was all these confirmations. I'm like, got it, good. I'm gone. And so I'm not on those pills. But it's a hard thing, and it's a tough thing. And I know you've been there before. To be in the same household with a person that you think that's going to be supportive of you and that you're going to do this together and that, you know, you're doing this for your family and you're doing this so you can get a better, foot on life and prosper a little bit with the family. And this person is fighting you tooth and nail to try to sabotage it because maybe they know they're not going to go anywhere themselves and they don't want you to go or they feel like you're going to leave. And that's exactly what I did. But if I had that support, had that kind of, you know, I'm with you the whole ride, maybe things would have turned out differently.
Oh, yeah, my brother. Like I said earlier, bro.
And you're coming home to it every single day. There's no break. You're coming home to it every single day. It's just what it is. I'll say something real quick. It was interesting. I remember when I was married. I've always had an eye or just a desire to play with the stock market. I don't know what about it always intrigued me. When I came back to Connecticut, I had a chance to basically be get a job on the floor in New York to work the floor. I got the book, the study book, whatever. At that time, there were trained brokers and trained people to be down on the floor. And it was long days, it had been a long day, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you know what? I'm a married man. I don't need to spend that much time working from home. I'm going to pass on that. But it didn't take me away from really still wanting to know what was going on with the stock market and stuff of that nature. And, you know, put some money into it. So, and here again, you don't have to be part of what's going on, but you may want to. So, as I started to do things where money would be put in certain places in the stock market, before I would ever do anything, I would go and say, hey, this is going to be X, Y, Z. This is going to be that. This is going to happen. That's going to take place. I'm trying to get here. There will be zero interest.
Zero,
my brother. So, you know, made some moves. Some things worked out well. Some things were starting to pop. So my thing is, okay, you had no interest. You received no benefits. So when I knew that the marriage itself was going to kind of dissipate and go in a different direction, I went and closed everything out, my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Close it out. Give me this. Okay, thank you very much. Give me that. Thank you very much. Give me this. Because at the end of the day, you didn't sit in that motherfucking boat. You're not taking home the prize. You're not taking home the prize. You chose not to have any interest. And therefore, you choose, in my opinion, you should not benefit from it. It just shouldn't happen. So, you know, yeah, there's that, there again. That's a perfect example of basically not really understanding or supporting to be there. But
I
guarantee you at that time, if she knew it was available, her hand would have been out.
Would have been out. You
put this in my hand, no. And some of it, she still has no idea what I've done.
Cool.
You know, I know she asked me about one thing I closed out. Why do you want it? Because we don't need it. We simply don't need it. We don't. We didn't need it. But I hear you, bro. I'm going to take us on a different path before we come to some what might be in two gentlemen's mind. I want to do something. I want to go to a moment in our lives, man. Take a moment where we experienced a moment that had a real, at the moment, it was profound, and it's something that you think about, it always brings you joy. And I'm giving you a chance to kind of think about it in a sense before I come to you and ask, you know, what that particular moment might be. I thought about mine today. I thought about this. I remember years ago, man, T.D. Jakes, you know, the bishop, Reverend T.D. Jakes, used to do things called manpower. And what manpower was a, he traveled at the time. I think he stopped doing it years later. And before he stopped doing it, he was only having it at his church in Dallas, Texas. But at the time, he would travel to different places, and it would be a chance for men, just men, to get together and worship and talk and hear, you know, service for the most part. But the first one I went to was in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I remember being excited about going, bro. And I didn't know what to expect. But I remember being excited. And it was held at the Charlotte Coliseum. So I'm assuming this place must hold 10,000, 14,000 or whatever, bro. And it's supposed to be for men only. But there were some men, some cowards that brought their wives, their girlfriends. I call them cowards. They're not supposed to be there, bro. I don't care what she says to you. But anyway, going in, there was something about just the energy, man, going in, walking into the building and being there and seeing nothing but other brothers. It was us, Spanish guys, white guys. It was just an array of men. And I remember he came out. And he started talking, and he said, we all came from different places. There were people there from Detroit. Of course, there were some Connecticut, from all different. There were some people from foreign countries that were there. And it was amazing to see you're hugging and talking to other men that you don't even know. It is all based around the loving of God. Bro, that was some stuff, man. That was some stuff. You talked about stuff that we go through as fathers, we go through as men. What we feel, and that's why I said women should have been there. There was no place for them to be because it was a chance for men just to kind of basically expose and really go deep into what we feel, not putting on the front of a man, just basically just crying out and saying, these are things that bother us, these are things that hurt us, that's inside of us. And that was, and I went to a couple of more. He did it again. Ooh, the following year he did in Atlanta, and the following year when it happened in Atlanta, I our cousin, Mr. Reese, Alonzo, I told him about it. He was a little concerned, a little curious. He said, bro, come on, man. I'm going to tell you, it's going to be nothing like this. So he went. Alonzo was amazed, bro. Was absolutely amazed. Because there was something about men, just men getting together, man, and just basically hearing the word of God. Listening to it, and responding to it, just responding to it. No filters, no nothing, just hearing it. Not a bunch of hooting and hollering, the direction being passed around. And there was something so special unique about that. And I always think back to them from those two particular times. I think I might have went one more time, and that was in Dallas. But when it was in Dallas, it just wasn't the same as it was because it seemed like people, when it was in Dallas, didn't really travel to it. But when it's in Atlanta, and the first one he did at that, to my knowledge, at that time was in Charlotte. Those two times, man, stellar. Absolutely stellar. Mr. Charles, if you have something, man, I know this might be impromptu, but if you have something, bro, you want to share, we're ready to listen.
Yeah, I think for me it was, I remember, I don't know if I told you guys this before, but my father's family has to have family reunions like every 2 years. And people come from all over. So the average sometimes has been as many as 400 people, and the minimum is usually about 300. And we do this every couple of years. So it's like the heads of the family come together, and however they're brought into the family, we recognize the legacy and the tradition. So this particular time, they had the reunion in Ohio. And well, I'm from down in Dayton, so I was able to travel down there, kind of hang out for the weekend. I had been to one of these before, a couple of them before, but the fact that it was in my hometown was even more special because for a long time I had, probably had issues that I struggled with just realizing about the family situation. I mean, not like I would be crying out about it, but mentally at times I thought about, being by myself and, somewhat, I guess, considered more or less like an orphan. But I never really talked about that. But this particular time, you know how they do it. On the third Friday, they have a special night. Saturday is an activity. And Sunday morning is usually church. So anyhow, we're downtown Dayton, Ohio. People come down for the church. So we come into the building, and we go into the room, and everybody's excited. And everybody's taking their place to get ready for church. And it was in the summertime, but for some reason or another, the electricity was out in the building. and particularly in this room. So that means no air conditioning and no lights and no electric for the organ or whatever we're going to do as far as the music, right? And we're just there. You got a number of people there waiting, and it's hot. So people just talking, wondering what's going on, what's going on. So 5-10 minutes goes along, and they go and talk to somebody, and they go, no, that's not, I'm sorry, it's going to be a minute because we don't know what's going to happen. So we're like just sitting there, everybody's like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you just bear with us, we're going to try to work on this situation. And people are talking and whatnot, and within 5 minutes, one of the elders, one of our older cousins from Tallahassee, Florida, came up and talked to somebody, whispered to somebody, and these people started clapping, started singing an old Negro spiritual. This man was singing, and I'm going to tell you, man, it was like being down home in the church, and we had music, and we started singing the song, and there was not a dry eye in the place. And for me, because it came so far to hit so close to home, because no electricity, it was like being back in the day. I started crying like a baby because I realized when I looked around the room, all these people were related to me. And I was home. I was finally home. Everybody in the building was related to me. I was home. This was my family. And maybe about 25 minutes later, the lights came back on. And people's like, they can keep them off because we don't even need them. But just that whole premise of how powerful the moment was, man, I would never in my life forget that. And that just reminds me of who I, where I'm from, where I come from, and realizing that I'm truly never alone.
Good stuff, my brother. Very good stuff.
Mr. Demon Reese, what would you like to add, sir?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this before I go into to a moment for me, but family, don't underestimate the power of family reunions. Man, they're great things to have, and it keeps you connected. It reminds you of a lot of things and the presence there. But I think what did it for me was the Million Man March. Traveling there with my boy, and one of my best friends in the whole world, Daryl Bush from Maywood, Illinois, us just talking during the bus ride and talking to other men on the bus and walking around our backpacks, man, and just soaking in the experience of brothers from all over the country and sometimes all over the world. That positivity, man, I don't think I've ever experienced that ever again. With men of color getting together and the positivity that you felt during that time. I can't remember if there was any, I don't think there was any incidents of crime, fights, none of that stuff. And to your point, Mark, there were women there. I don't know why they were there. I don't know who invited them, but it wasn't for them. I don't know why. I still don't understand to this day why they were there. But it was just a powerful moment. It made you reflect and think that, you know, despite all the depiction of the negativity of black men, in the news and movies and all that other stuff, that's not what we experienced that day. And I've talked to men who attended that I did not get to share that with. I know my dad was there. I know there are a few friends that I know from school and family members that were there. And the crowd was so big, you just didn't get to see them. But you felt loved and embraced by everybody there. And it really kind of gave me this kind of moment just to think, if we could do this together after we walk away from this, we'd be a powerful force on this globe. And it gave me that slight vision of that. If we got together, how powerful we could be. If we join forces and get away from all this silliness and pettiness and negativity that is around us, we could really be a force. And so, even in those moments on that weekend, It gave me that kind of vision that, that, you know, we are stronger than we think we are. And if we really kind of just come together collectively, man, nothing that can stop us.
Bro, I'm going
to double down on what you said about the Million Man March, man, because I remember that day, like it was yesterday, bro, I really did. I caught the train from Connecticut, and, you know, the train makes stops in Connecticut. We went to New York, we went to Philly, we went to Maryland, went to D.C. And I remember, you know, when we was leaving Connecticut, you had some, you know, some of us on there. A few amount, good amount, not a lot. Bro, when the train left New York, the time it started going up, it was all black, bro. It was nothing but brothers on the train, nothing. And when we got to Washington, when you walked, even before we got to it, the Million Man March was having, it was being held, it was nothing but brothers all over the place, bro. Just going there. Some singing, the walking, joking. It was like Washington turned into Africa, and that, I'm not saying that to be nothing else than what it felt like. It, like it just turned into it, and the whole entire time, it just felt that way. It just felt like you were basically in another land, another country, where you're supposed to be. It was so much consideration to where if you bumped into someone, they turn around, they apologize, you know, they ask you where you're from. Anything. It was just more than I could ever imagine and would hope to be. And I remember coming back on the train, and it was a show at the time, Rock. I remember the show Rock that was on. And the father, Rock's father, I can't remember the actor's name, but he came back on the train that I was on. And he was talking. And when I tell you, when that cat was talking about the old days, cats were sitting at his feet listening. Everybody just kind of huddled around him. Nobody said a word.
Let's take a little break.
When we come back, we see what the panel is thinking about. It's When Black Men Talk. This is Tim Reese, Mr. Charles, Mark Elliott.
Mr. Charles, we'll come to you first, sir.
I mean, something might have been on your mind that you've been thinking about that you want to see what we're thinking about. This is your opportunity, my brother.
Yeah, when DeMaurice mentioned something a few minutes ago, it came to my mind, so I just wanted to draw it more or less out as a question. Have you in your lifetime made a sacrifice? The opportunity to do something, and but you made a sacrifice to allow somebody else to do it, or have that opportunity because you knew in the end they would benefit the most out of it. But you made the initial sacrifice.
Oh yeah, it's funny.
I can't think of nothing specifically, but I'm sure, man. Yeah, I'm sure. I think we all have those moments in our life where we're called to do something or help somebody in a form where it benefits them more than it could possibly benefit you. And, yeah, without a doubt. I wish I could think of a specific case, but, yeah, I've noticed points in times in my life where I put people in front of me, meaning that I put their well-being, what they needed, attended to, what they needed, as opposed to sacrificing for myself. And I kind of learned that from my mother. You know, my mother was one that was in a sense where if my mother had a dollar, she wouldn't give it to you. If I also didn't think about where her next dollar's coming from. If she had a dollar and that dollar was going to benefit you, guess what? You're getting it. And I've seen her do that numerous times, and the dollar she did will come back to be $10 back to her.
So,
and it's not that you give knowing that's going to come back. You give because that's what your heart tells you to do, or that you sacrifice because that's what your heart tells you to do. So, yeah, I mean, growing up and seeing that with her, it was going to be hard for me not to, to be that way, which is hard, man. It's just, so, yeah, it just, now, if I'm one, I will say this, I've done that in the past, and, you know, it didn't seem like it mattered to you, the next time you're not getting my dollar. You don't give a sacrifice, you don't get my dollar. That definitely was the case. Your response to the question is different.
Yeah, I there are many times that happens. I know as a professor and kind of giving knowledge and sharing that with your students, seeing them benefit from it and starting their own practice and all that other stuff, it just makes you proud. Just giving them and them coming back to you saying, man, it wasn't for you. That's a great feeling. Also, I'll tell a quick story I told the other day. And it was this play that I was in the sketch comedy group years ago. And it was this play that the head of the sketch comedy group wanted me to try out for with a guy that we had on the show, Mars Timms, who used to work for the Bulls and do the entertainment for the Bulls. And he had wrote this play. And I didn't want to be in this play. I really didn't want to be in this play. And then it was this cat who was up for the part too. So I kind of didn't give a great audition because I really don't want to be in this play. I got a lot to do, and maybe this guy would benefit from it. The guy that benefited from it was, I don't know if you watch Saturday Night Live, but Chris Redd, the comedian and the actor and the guy who's in this show that I love called Disjointed on Netflix. And I'm so proud of what he's become and what he's doing with his career and how he, you know, really kind of just spread his wings and just got out there. And I went to go after just to support him and support Mars. I actually went to the play that he was part of. And the play wasn't that good, but Chris made it funny to be, you know, he turned that part and made it funny and made it work. And I think that was some of the stepping stones of his career and moving on and going out and doing things and being funny and being out in front of a crowd. He's younger than me. And so just to see him kind of just flourish and his career just blossom is amazing. Other people would be jealous, like, man, I should have took that part and I would have been, no, not me. I'm like, man, it was destined for him to do that. And I'm so proud of him to this day.
Mr. Charles, your reaction, sir?
Yeah, when Dee Maurice mentioned something earlier, like I said, years ago I used to work for an African-American newspaper. And, you know, we would always go to different things and whatnot. So the time was coming up for around the Million Man March time. And out of the selection, our editor said, we have one slot on the bus, so somebody can ride to the bus and basically write a story about what's going on. You basically write the story with photos and the whole nine. You basically are going to, you know, you're going to just basically show us about your journey through your whole journey. You're going to journal this all the way through to Washington and back. And everybody's wondering who's going to get to go. And when it came out to it, down to it, the editor said I was going. And I was excited, man. And they talked, other people in the office was like, man, that's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And we had some other reporters there. And we had one young brother that was like, man, I wish I could go. Man, that is so great. And I thought about it, and I was like, man, this is it. Million Man March, you cannot miss this. This is a golden opportunity. This is life-changing, right? And then I thought about this young man, and I thought about this young man, and not saying nothing because of where he's from, but with how he grew up. But he was from the East Coast. He was transplanted. He went to school here in Ohio. But he grew up in suburbia, out in New Jersey, suburbia, and then he came to Columbus, Ohio, and ended up with a Minority newspaper, but by talking to him and his experience was nowhere near, to me, he just didn't have an understanding of what we consider the true black experience is, what it's like for a black man to go through certain things and be around his brothers. And I made a decision, and I decided to let him go. And he went. And for as much as I wanted to go, and I was like, man, what the hell have you done? I said that to myself a couple times. But I knew deep in my spirit, in my heart, he needed it more than I did. Because he had, to me, he just wasn't clued in like he should have been. And what you guys mentioned, I hear from other people, it was an amazing time. I look at it and just go, wow, to be there must have been amazing. And all I was hoping is that it helped change his life. And to all accounts that you came back, it sounded that way, but I'm not sure. But all I know is something I felt I needed to do. And if I didn't do anything else, I made a difference in his life to what it, let him understand what it is to be a black man.
Good stuff, bro. Real good stuff.
I remember when we came back, that one thing that Mr. Farrakhan said, that fathers need to step up and be fathers. And I remember there was a lawyer here in New Haven, man. He was inundated with fathers taking, wanted full control of their kids, bro. They wanted custody, full custody of their kids. And I remember I got a part, at that point, I got a part of there's some cats in Haven doing some mentor programs. A lot of things kind of spurred from the Many Men March. We started mentoring some young men and doing some things. So a lot of things came from that. It didn't have a lot of longevity, but, yeah, I mean, and for most that went, I guarantee you to kind of live with them today and beyond. And it's just, that was a day that, a day of no other, bro. A day of no other. Beautiful thing you did, Mr. Charles. Beautiful thing, because we need to, especially, I'm telling you now, we need to pass the torch, bro. We need to pass the torch to younger cats and younger brothers and let them see and understand, because some of their roles haven't been the roles that we travel. They may not understand that some of the things that we understand. Dean Maurice, your turn, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to get your brother's thoughts about the sentencing in the George Floyd case. I know it struck me kind of different. Hearing some of the people speak before the sentencing. I wanted to get your thoughts.
Yeah, if I remember correctly,
I think he got, 22 years? If you look at the amount of years, I mean, you take someone's life that way, yeah, I'm not going to say 20 years is enough, but it's not a little either. It's an amount. So I didn't have a problem with it. I didn't pay attention to, I kind of waited to the numbers came down and just kind of looked at that. I didn't follow what people were saying, because people could be idiots, bro, idiotic stuff that people say. I remember I saw somebody say something about how his mother was talking, and, it's just, that's just, ignorance is not crayons, bro. You can't just color it. It's just, it is what it is. And there's a big part of ignorance in this country, a huge part of it. But I'm glad that for 22 years, his life is going to be different. It's going to be different. It's just going to be totally different. From what he knew, from that day he woke up, that particular day, before that happened, he will never see that again for 22 years, bro. Now, I don't know how his jail life is going to be. At some point, it's going to get rough for him. For 22 years, they ain't gonna be able to protect you and cover you all the time, bro. This ain't gonna happen. So for that, yes, for 22 years, let his life remind him of the, of the act that he did that was utterly unnecessary. So yeah, I mean, for that point, I'll take it. If it was anything less than that, if it was single digit, I would have been totally upset. Totally upset. But for 22 years, at his age, yeah. Because to me, 22 minutes in jail is ridiculous. 22 years, that's a long time. Mr. Charles, your response?
Yeah, I was kind of torn at first, but then when I started realizing what was going on, I listened to some of the people. Of course, the family would not think that 22 years is enough, and I get that because it was a personal loss. I would love to see the max 40 years, but 22 years is nothing to sneeze at. It was a 5 years, and they were talking about these ridiculous mentions about probation and all this other stuff, and I'm like, really? But the fact that the judge saw through this crap, and then the people together, the jurors came together and made sure that this was the right call, and with the conviction in itself to find him guilty, says a lot. But I want to say, I think they made a statement, and I'm not sure. I'm not saying they're going to change the way we see it, and no more black people going to get killed, nothing like that. But it shows you, for me anyway, that it does. We do matter, man. We do matter. And granted, some people may still feel the same way, but 22 years, man, is a long time for killing that brother. And most importantly, I'm glad about the sentencing, because the man was deliberate in his action. He knew he could do it, and he swore in his mind that he'd get away with it. And no matter what he did, it showed him, hell no, you can't. Everybody saw it. They watched it on TV, and you still thought you were above the law, but you're going to be thinking about that for the next 22 and a half years. So we finally, there's some justice, in my opinion, with that. And you can say what you want to about George Floyd and what his situation was and his habits, what he was dealing with in life, but it still did not dignify. You should not feel like you could just do that to any human being. So I felt it was just in the standpoint of it was more, it's enough for me. I'll leave that there.
D. Maurice, man.
Yeah, no, the years weren't enough for me, because he'll probably do half those years unless the federal case puts more years in prison for that. So that bothered me. But what bothered me the most is I began to understand his attitude, the guy that is going to jail. I only want to, you know, say his name, by listening to the mom. Because she in her heart feels that he is innocent, and takes no responsibility for this. She didn't even give condolences to the family. And so watching him during the trial and his nonchalant attitude, like he was innocent, and his surprise when they found him guilty, this is where it comes from. You are accountable, ma'am. You are accountable for creating this monster. And you can't accept accountability. He can't accept accountability. And now that his daughter, when I was listening to his daughter, she is without a father, because none of you could accept accountability. And the way you raise your child is that this is acceptable. You can do this. So I put blame on not only him, but his mother, the way she came over the attitude. You got to give ownership to your kids about what they do wrong. Regardless, right or wrong, you got to call it out. He was wrong. Everybody saw the videotape. Ma'am, I know you saw the videotape. But you can't bring yourself to say, you know what, condolences to the family for what my son's done. I apologize, you know, and take the heat for that. You raised this monster. You raised this guy who didn't give a damn about a black man under his knee. And how dare you get up in the court and not acknowledge that a family's hurt, that a daughter is without her father, that brothers and sisters are without their brothers, and claim that your son is innocent. This is part of the problem in this country. No accountability. This is they think it's justified for this to happen, that he shouldn't go to jail for this because he's a good man. Okay. Okay. To you he is, but we all look at it, you created this monster. I hope you have a good time going to visit him where he's staying, his new residence.
I'm going to put a
question out, man. I said this on the sports show tonight, and the two gentlemen came up with two good responses. But I look at the Naomi, I think that's her name, is the tennis player. I love her. I love the system. I really do. She basically is walking away saying, I'm going to play tennis when I want to. I'm going to play when I feel like I want to. I don't care what you think. I don't care what you feel. There's so many words she's saying to me. It wasn't about the money for me. And believe it or not, she has made, this year alone, in endorsements. I was reading about her. That young lady has made $75 million.
Just
in 2021, in endorsements alone. So I respect her highly when she says, I'm not playing in the French. I'm not playing in Wilmington. I'm not playing in Olympics, and here's why. And then Serena comes after her.
I'm not going to play in the Olympics, but I'm not going to tell you why. Maybe another day.
But my question to you gentlemen is this. Why are black athletes running to basically get gold for this country? That's the question. Why are they running, Mr. Grease, to put gold around their neck for our country that sometimes don't love them as much as they love the country?
I think some of them are under the sad illusion that they'll be accepted by this country by putting the USA uniform on in the red, white, and blue. Some of them are doing it because it feeds into their brand. Everybody globally is going to be watching this, and if they shine, then that just enhances their brand. And some people are just not socially conscious at all. They're just not socially conscious to even have that on their screen, their mental screen, that I need to boycott because I need to make a statement about what's happening in this country, and I can't represent it the way it's currently going at this particular time. So those are the three things that I'll hit.
Mr. Charles, your response, sir.
Yeah, I think a lot of the athletes, particularly ones that are not in in a lot of major revenue sharing sports, or sports that make a lot of money, I think a lot of people do it for endorsements. I think because they know that's their time. Every 4 years, they can make a lot of money, particularly if they win gold. The other part of it, too, is I think that, as you mentioned, DeMaurice mentioned about trying to be a patriot for this country. I remember back in the 60s when we read the stories about when George Foreman was the champion, and everybody else was talking about boycotting and the whole thing about, Tommy Smith and, about John Carlos and Tommy Smith. That George Foreman got really ridiculed because they said, "Why are you smiling like you just won $1 million when we out here on the ground struggling and whatnot?" He called hell for that, but I think that's what a lot of people are in this. It's kind of one of those things where some of these athletes, if it does not affect me, then it's not really happening, right? If it's not affecting me directly, so I think that's what it is for a lot of them. And truth be told, I don't think a lot of us understand how much money. And I'm not using that as an excuse why they do it, but it's the real fact, how much money people make off these Olympics when they participate, and particularly if they win. It's a lot of money. Is that right? Should they be more smarter than that? Should they be more of a, not so much of a sellout? I would say yes. But realistically speaking, like so many other things we talk about on our shows, the dollar wins out often.
Oh, yeah. When it
comes to black women, the dollar wins most of the time, bro. Because black women mentality, I'm going to get mine, you get yours. And I'm not knocking anybody that decides to go play in the Olympics, but I would think that at this current time, it's not a smart move to do. It just isn't. It really isn't. But, if you got to go get yours, you got to go get yours, but I would think that you would think so. That's not smart. I look at NBA players. And they're fighting. Now, these are the same cats who wore all the T-shirts last year, and the NBA had all the stuff on the court. And they can't get out of the playoffs quick enough. We said before, they say they're playing the Olympics. they can't get out. And I'm saying to myself, you have these guaranteed $150, $60 million contracts. And you're right, Mr. Charles, there's money to be made, and it's going to come after. But at what point, man, do you just stop and think, okay, I'm comfortable enough to where, I could just pass that on. But no. And I don't expect everybody to be social, on a social justice, and they put that in the forefront. But at some times, I just think sometimes you just got to understand, you are a black person in America. First. It's just what it is. You are. Whether you want to believe it or not, that's what it comes down to. But, you know, they tend to kind of walk away from that and act like it doesn't exist. So, yeah, it just kind of surprised me. But I'll go back to what I said about Serena Williams. She can't even say why she don't want to go. 39 years old, afraid of the backlash and say, I'm not going for this reason. When you have a woman basically 15, 14 years younger, you say, you know what? I don't give a damn what you think. I'm not going. And I'll tell you why I'm not going. So it's just, I don't understand when some of them will ever get it. I don't think they will. I really just don't think they will. I'm going to change gears a little bit, gentlemen, because this came across to me a few days ago, and it kind of took me by surprise. I remember years ago, we were looking at the opioid, what was going on with that, and it was kind of quiet, but it was happening a lot. But solidly, black people are dying from overdose of opioids more than we are understanding. For a while, it was painted as a rural white affliction that basically white people was dying. It was dying by droves. And you saw what happened. They start coming out with these care centers, all this other stuff. But we have found the reason that it intensified in our community. In St. Louis alone, last year, black people increased dying three times the rate as white people. Over, you know, opioids, just ODing on it. Not just getting high to the point where they're dying. Now, you know, this didn't pop up on CNN or anything of that nature. It may never. It just may not happen. But when we think about everything else that's going on with us as a race of people, we're killing ourselves at a high rate. Bang, bang, bang. We're doing that at a high rate. We got officers that are killing us. Now we found a way to basically kill ourselves again with opioids. What's your reaction to it, Mr. Jones?
I think it's sad. It really is for our folks to go down that road. I don't say I understand it, but I recognize it because when you think about opioids, they have become a lot more accessible to us. And a lot of times in our community, when something becomes a lot more accessible as far as price and easy to receive, we're all over it. You think about how crack was introduced, so many other things, how heroin at a certain point, when it became to a point where it became affordable. Cocaine has always been around, but it's not been as accessible to the average person, which is why the invention of crack. But these opioids have become very accessible now, where now you can get them and you can get them kind of cheap, relatively cheap. And also, too, from somebody that has been through that as far as pain is concerned and had them, they're easy to take, man. They're easy to take. It's almost like sleeping pills in a way, to a point where you feel a certain kind of way. And if you can digest the pills, it can take you where you want to go. So it's easy to take. It's not like it's something like, oh, my goodness. You know, it's just easier to get your hands on, easier to take. And I can see why some people are not able to, I guess, handle it and overdose, particularly if you're looking for a way to take away the pain that you have. It's a lot going on there, bro.
Ms. DeMaurice, if you give us a response in about a minute, so I would appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Charles kind of said it all. At one particular point, we didn't have access to it in the black community. And now that we have access, it just seems like we're not heeding the warnings of what was happening in other communities that were white. And so it's just a sad situation, man. It's just a sad situation. I was thinking about the song Escapism by James Brown when Charles was talking. And so it's become another form of escapism. And unfortunately, if folks aren't careful, that escapism can mean your death. So hopefully we'll turn this around, man. This is something else that we need to put on the radar and deal with as a community.
One black friend told.